anomalous. And we also showed that the result of that is that QCD has this extra parameter, which violates CP, and that this is very strongly constrained. It looks like there's a tuning between different parameters. So any outstanding issues?
Does this not happen in the electric?
That's a very good question. So there are two, so the simple answer is that the electric weak interactions don't really matter, because we have this, the action associated with these instanton transitions is 8 pi squared delta n over g squared. And if this is g weak squared, then this number is about 130 or so. So all of the processes, the rate goes like e to the minus 130. So even though there is, in principle, this CP-violating parameter, it doesn't actually have any physical effect in low energies. It turns out that in the standard model, you can actually do a bunch of rotations on the field, and you can redefine it to be zero. So there's this general principle in field theories where there are various field bases, right? Because when we write down the path integral, we're integrating over different fields. The action of these fields. And I can do various transformations on the fields, f of phi 1, phi 2. And then, of course, there's some corresponding transformation of the measure. But if I can do a field redefinition that eliminates a parameter from my Lagrangian, it means it wasn't a real parameter to begin with. Okay. Just because all we're doing here is basically a change of integration variable in some sense. And so if I can transform my integration variables to cancel some number that appears here, then it means that the final answer can't depend on that, because I found a way of expressing the integral that's independent of it. So that's basically what happens with the weak theta angle, is that you can make it unphysical. OK, any other questions? Oh, the other thing I should point out is you also haven't asked about the U1 theta angle. So remember that all of this stuff about instantons, we computed for SU2. So for SU2 weak, obviously, this is a reasonable thing to calculate. For SU3 strong, you can decompose this into a bunch of SU2s. Basically, there are 8 generators. You can combine them into various groups of 3 that form SU2. So there are various SU2 subgroups of SU3. So we also expect there to be instantons of SU3. And this is true for all of the SUN groups. In U1, what you're trying to do is find these winding configurations. And if you think about having a sphere, if I have a U1, so I have some sort of circle that's on the sphere, I can always contract it to a point, no matter how I try and wrap it around. So it turns out that for U1, there are no instantons in 4D. So pretty much, we don't ever have to worry about the U1 part of this. OK. So today, what we're going to talk about are QCD axions and axion dark matter. So we've kind of had a digression where we've talked about some aspects of quantum field theory and of the standard model. And we're going to see a bunch of those elements kind of coming together to both motivate the existence of the QCD axion as a solution to this strong CP problem. And then what we'll show is that it can be dark matter in the same way that we saw that you can have scalar dark matter from the vacuum misalignment production mechanism. Okay. So just to remind ourselves, the strong CP problem is that our QCD action generically contained a bunch of masses. And then there was also this theta parameter. And we found that there could be, these are in principle complex numbers. And so there's an effective theta angle, which is theta minus the argument of the determinant of m. And this violates the CP symmetry. And it in turn leads to a neutron electric dipole moment, which is very strongly constrained. And so this tells us that this combination of these parameters has to be less than about 10 to the minus 10. And this strong CP problem has been around since the 70s. So this is not a new phenomenon. Back then, it wasn't a 1 part in 10 to the 10 cancellation. It was like 1 part in 10 to the 6 or something. But as experiments have improved and continue to not see a neutron electric dipole moment, this problem has gotten worse and worse. So we can write down some resolutions to the problem that could be an explanation. So the simplest one is that CP is a conserved symmetry. So basically, when I'm writing down my Lagrangian, I just sort of say by fiat, I'm not going to allow any terms that violate CP, in which case theta is going to be exactly 0. Now, the problem is that we do observe CP violation. Okay, in particular in the kaon system. So if you look at neutral kaons, you see that they can be subdivided to CP odd and CP even. And sometimes the CP even state decays into CP odd final states. So we actually see in hadronic physics CP violation. This is consistent with the CKM phase, namely that in the standard model with 3 generations of quarks, there's 1 CP violating parameter. And the CP violating parameter has to be about order 1 in order to see, in order for CP violation to be as big as we see it in the kaon system. Okay. And I just wanted to remind you, if you don't know, that it was actually the observation of CP violation that led people to predict the existence of a third generation. Because in just 2 generations, you don't get CP violation in the standard model, and or at that point, just the quark model. And so really, it was this discovery of CP violation that made people think, okay, well, if we add an extra one, then we get the CP phase. And this won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. Okay. So what you need to do is start out with a theory that conserves CP and then break it in some way. And the problem is that breaking it, say, spontaneously, typically induces large theta as well. So there isn't really a good way to, say, create a CKM phase and not create a theta angle. You can kind of see that because the CKM phase sort of shows up in this mass matrix as well. And so what we're saying is that particular combinations of the masses can get a phase, and particular combinations of the masses cannot get a phase. And that's sort of weird. So there are 1 or 2 models that do this, but this is not seen as a very good or robust solution to the problem, just because there's no good way of separating the theta parameter from the CKM phase. The second possibility is that there's a massless quark. And basically, the idea is that if I have a massless quark, then the Lagrangian of my massless quark is just I q bar d slash q. Okay, which is just, you know, q left dagger, q left, plus q right dagger, q right. And so if I do the transformation q goes to q e to the minus I theta effective, the Lagrangian stays unchanged because when I make this, let's say, q left, if I make this rotation, this term just is invariant because it's a q dagger and a q, but it changes my theta parameter to theta effective minus theta effective, which is 0. Okay? Because remember that this transformation is anomalous, when I make an anomalous transformation, it shifts the theta parameter. So this is just what I was saying before, that I found a definition of the fields where I've canceled off the theta parameter, and it just doesn't exist in my theory. So this means that this is unphysical, and it can't actually show up in any rates, because if I were very careful and computed my rates all in this particular basis, I would never see a theta pop up anywhere. Okay, the problem with this is that there are no massless quarks. So we can't directly measure the masses of the up and down quarks because they're way below lambda QCD, but their existence changes the spectrum of hadrons. And so what you can do is you can run lattice calculations and say, what if one of the quarks were massless? And you end up with a spectrum that totally disagrees with the observed hadron spectrum. So to a very high degree of confidence, this is just not viable either. So the third solution, something called the axion. And the axion is motivated as follows, where what we can do is we can compute the vacuum energy as a function of theta. So this is a non-perturbative calculation, so I'm not going to go through it. But if you took the BSM course and you learned about the chiral Lagrangian, basically what you can do is you can put the theta parameter into the mass matrix and then move to the chiral Lagrangian, and then it's very easy to calculate the potential. What you find is that the potential has a very simple form. The potential as a function of theta is lambda QCD to the fourth, 1 minus cosine theta effective. Now, this lambda QCD makes sense because it's non-perturbative dynamics that are driving the physical consequences of this theta parameter. So that's sort of the only dimensionful thing it can depend on. And then it has this interesting periodic structure. And what we notice about this is that theta effective of equal to 0 is the minimum energy. So if I were to imagine different theta parameters were allowed, then the one that has theta parameter of 0 is the minimum energy. Now, as you showed in the tutorial, the standard model is time invariant, like the theta vacua are the time independent vacua. So you can't really change from one theta vacuum to another. So this is just an academic exercise. Really what happens is that you randomly, you know, sometime whoever was writing down the Lagrangian to create the world said theta effective is some number, and then that's the energy of the vacuum, and that's just what we have to live with. Right? So in the standard model, this is sort of not a very important fact, but if we can make theta effective dynamical, then this potential will drive theta effective to 0. What I mean is that if I replace theta effective with some field here, then this field would get a VEV, which is essentially theta effective equal to 0. And this is precisely what the axion is. It's a dynamical field that drives the effective theta parameter in the vacuum to 0. Now, how can we see this happening? So suppose I have a pseudoscalar, and the interaction, which I'm going to call A, the interaction Lagrangian, I'm just going to write down. I'm going to say it has this form. So if I have a new scalar degree of freedom, which couples to the trace of GG tilde, then we see that this is exactly the same form as the theta parameter. The theta parameter term looks like this. Okay. So this means that What I expect to happen is I can write down my potential as a function of theta effective and A as lambda QCD to the fourth, 1 minus cosine theta effective plus A. And of course, the vacuum for this is just A equals minus theta effective times F, because this makes the potential go to zero. And so then when I plug it into this Lagrangian, I just get zero. So basically what I've done is I've taken a field and I couple it in exactly the same way as the theta parameter. And so when I do that, it shows up exactly in the same place as this potential as the theta parameter. And it's the same calculation that brings you here that brings you here. And so if this A is allowed to evolve, it naturally falls into its minimum, which exactly cancels the theta parameter. So what the axion solution does is it says that that there is some arbitrary theta parameter, but there's also this extra field which exactly cancels it out. So that in the IR, it doesn't matter what my theta parameter was when I wrote down the Lagrangian. The one that I measure, which is the sum of the VEV of A and theta, is always going to be zero. Okay. Gabriel.
Can you just say again how you got that?
The cosine?
Yeah.
So I mean, there are a few different ways you can do it. So one of them is you can do these sum over instanton calculations, and you calculate the energy associated with these, and you do the sort of infinite limit of that. The simpler way to do it is in the chiral Lagrangian. So I'm not actually explaining how this shows up, but you know that it has to be periodic in cosine theta, and you can make some arguments where if it's rare to get an instanton, then when we wrote down our, like, theta is sum over n e to the I n theta, and that if only sort of some adjacent values of n are important, then you can kind of pick up a cosine of theta here, and that's the energy. So there's some sort of hand-wavy ways that you can argue that it has to be a 1 minus cosine, but really you have to do the calculation yourself, but we don't really have all of the machinery to do that in class. So if you're interested in doing this, I'm very happy to give the references. And this is actually a problem in Srebrenicki 94.2, I think. So if you like read the relevant sections, there's like a section on the chiral Lagrangian and then this section on theta vacua, then they take you through the process of calculating this potential. Any other questions? We're minimizing this potential.
Right.
So theta is a constant, and then I know that cosine is at its maximum when this is zero, and so that's how I got it. I mean, technically, you can take the derivative and find it that way. Yeah. Ah, A over F. Yes, good. That's where this F comes from. Good. I have it in my notes, but it was kind of penciled in, so I didn't see it. Good. Okay, so how do we get this interaction? So remember that if I take psi goes to e to the I alpha gamma 5 psi, then this is the same as taking theta goes to theta plus 2 alpha. So this suggests that if I want this to be a field, A is a function of x, that I'm going to want something that shows up as e to the I a of x in some anomalous symmetry. I want it to shift when I do a global transformation. And of course, the thing that should jump out at you is if we have a shift symmetry, we want this to be a Goldstone boson. So we expect that the axion is going to be the Goldstone boson of an anomalous symmetry. And so when I write the e to the I a over f in my action, I can do some rotation that's anomalous, and it'll pop up in the gg tilde term. So as an example, I'm going to consider a new theory where I have Q, which is a vector-like quark, meaning that it has both left and right-handed components. They're charged under SU3 in the triplet representation. And also under a spontaneously broken U1 axial symmetry. Okay. So what this means is that if I write down my Lagrangian, I guess this is really a covariant derivative because this is QCD, I have a kinetic term. I have this term here. And then I have some potential for the scalar. Now, I can't write down a mass for these quarks because a mass would break the axial symmetry, okay? Because the mass goes like psi left, psi right conjugate. And if psi left and psi right transform differently, then it's not invariant under the symmetry. Okay. So if I want to write down an axial symmetry at the level of the action, what I can do is psi left goes to e to the I alpha psi left, psi right goes to e to the minus I alpha psi right. That's the definition of an axial symmetry. And then in order to make this term invariant, this term looks like phi psi left psi right conjugate. Psi left psi right conjugate goes like e to the 2i alpha. So my phi has to be like e to the minus 2i alpha phi. And then at the level of the action, this is a legitimate symmetry. So now we want a Goldstone boson, so the symmetry has to be spontaneously broken. So this scalar here is going to get a VEV, FA over the square root of 2. And then just like we did the other day, we go into the broken phase representation. You also did this in the Higgs part of your first homework assignment. And I'm going to parameterize it as the Higgs boson of the U1A plus the VEV. And then there's going to be this Goldstone term, e to the IA. And we see that under the U1 axial, A over FA goes to A over FA minus 2 alpha. That's just from the fact that this is a real field, and so it doesn't transform at all. And this is the application of that shift. OK, is this good so far? OK, so now we can write the Yukawa coupling. So the Yukawa coupling looks like y over root 2 phi plus f of a e to the I f of a, psi left, psi right conjugate plus the Hermitian conjugate. So now what I can do is I can perform a U1 axial transformation, which is basically just a field redefinition of these psi fields. I'm going to take psi left goes to e to the minus IA over 2 FA. Psi left, psi right goes to e to the IA over 2 FA, psi right. And then I just end up with y over root 2 phi plus FA, psi left, psi right. And we see that this picks up a mass, m psi becomes FA over root 2. So these quarks that were massless now have a mass from the breaking of this axial symmetry. Now, hopefully, we've done enough with anomalies that the first thing you should think of when I do a transformation on an axial or a chiral symmetry is, you know, what is the anomaly associated with this? And these fields are charged under SU3. So there's a triangle diagram where we have the U1 axial, a gluon, and a gluon. And this leads to the usual anomaly term, which is, let's see. Just want to make sure I'm doing my signs consistently. I believe that there's a minus sign here. Trace G, G tilde. So this means that if I do, psi goes to e to the I alpha psi, then this shows up as minus g strong squared alpha over 16 pi squared trace g tilde. So now I see that I'm making this transformation e to the minus I a over 2 fa. Now gamma 5 is actually gives a minus sign for the left-handed and the plus sign for the right-handed. So this is like making the transformation e to the I over 2 FA gamma 5. So just plugging that in, I get g strong squared over 32 pi squared A over FA trace gg tilde. And this is exactly the form that I was predicting up there, except there's just a relative factor of 2. Okay. So now when I compute my potential, however you want to do it, I get lambda QCD to the fourth, 1 minus cos theta plus A over 2 FA. Okay, so there's an extra factor of 2 from what I did up there. But now the minimum of the potential is just A over FA is equal to minus 2 theta effective. And so there is no theta parameter at low energies. So adding in this new axial symmetry gave us a Goldstone boson, which when we rotated it into a particular basis showed up in this GG dual term. And then this exactly dynamically cancels the theta parameter. And I should say that this is typically known as a U1PQ, where this stands for Petche-Quinn, who are the people that first discovered this mechanism for solving the CP strong CP problem. Now, what Petche and Quinn didn't realize is that there's an actual particle, this A particle. They were just using symmetry properties, and they argued that this was the vacuum. But if you perturb around the vacuum, you actually get a particle associated with this field. Okay. So are there any questions about this sort of chain of logic that we followed? I know that it's kind of taken a few leaps and that I'm using a lot of the stuff that we've just derived in the past few days. So feel free to interrupt me. Oh, but the point is that we don't know what the neutron electric dipole moment is at high energies. So, and as we'll see, this actually turns out to be a blessing, okay? Because, not to give away the punchline, but this axion has a vacuum at low energies. At high energies, before lambda QCD sort of you know, at energies far above it, this potential is not turned on. So basically, we have an exact symmetry at high energies because the instantons that break the symmetry are very weak. And then at low energies, this vacuum, this potential turns on and it drives the axion to the vacuum. This is exactly what we needed for the misalignment production of dark matter. Okay, so just to put some physics of this particle in, we can talk about what the mass of this axion is. It's basically the second derivative of the potential evaluated around the vacuum. And this is just lambda QCD to the fourth over FA squared. So we see that there's basically one free parameter, which is this F axion. And this F axion determines what the axion mass is, because this is about 200 MeV. Axion cosmology. Okay, so what we need to do is know the potential above lambda QCD. Here you can do something called a dilute gas calculation of instantons, and I'm definitely not going to go through that because it's even worse than the earlier one. But you get some approximate parametric form for the axion mass. This goes like some alpha A lambda QCD. Sorry, not this isn't lambda, because this is just lambda to the fourth over T over lambda to the N. This lambda is about 400 MeV. This alpha A is some numerical parameter, and this N is also some numerical parameter. So these are some sort of approximate numerical calculation you can do. But the point is that at very high temperatures, this axion mass is zero, effectively. And this is what we expect, because going to high temperature makes the strong coupling weaker. And that means that my non-perturbative action is getting smaller, or sorry, is getting bigger and bigger. And the rate of these things is getting smaller and smaller. So this means that I start out with, it's an anomalous symmetry, but apart from the anomaly, it's conserved. And so my axion potential is just zero. And what we'll show is that in the early universe, you find yourself at some value of A naught. Okay? And this is usually about one, say, which isn't surprising because at high temperatures, you know, the value of this field is, you know, there's some angle associated with A. So it's, you know, going to be between 0 and pi, effectively. And so, you know, it's going to be probably some order 1 number. We don't know what this is. Maybe it's a prediction of inflation. Maybe it's just luck of the draw. Then at lambda QCD, we have a potential that turns on. Suddenly, we find ourselves not at the vacuum, but above the vacuum. And then this field starts to evolve. Okay. And remember that we showed a few days ago that this happened when the mass was 3 times the Hubble. And if we plug in this parametric equation, what we find is that the oscillation temperature is around a GeV. So it's not quite at lambda QCD, just because this mass is turning on, and Hubble is falling, and they cross at, you know, a GeV or so. OK, so then what we showed last time was that we had these equations of motion. Now, the one thing that's different, oh, sorry, I shouldn't make this phi. This is A, everywhere. Now, the one thing that's different is that this mass, before we considered it just as a constant, but really this axion mass is a function of temperature because it's evolving with the running of the strong coupling constant. But this is changing. So when MA is much bigger than Hubble, MA changes slowly compared to oscillation frequency. Okay, this is just the statement that M is changing sort of with the temperature, so it's evolving on Hubble timescales. If M is much bigger than Hubble, the frequency is much shorter than Hubble. And so you get very fast oscillations. And so we can do the same trick that we did before, which is we write the energy density for the axion field. And then we do a time average so that rho A is about the average value of A dot squared. And then what we find is that there's some slight difference from last time, which is that rho A dot has MA dot over MA minus 3H rho axion. So before we just had rho A dot is minus 3H rho axion. Now there's an additional MA dot over MA. But when we solve this equation, we see that it actually still gives us exactly the same form as we had before. It's just now we have MA as a function of time. So this is the scale factor. And so our whole reason for saying that this was dark matter is that the energy density redshifts like cold matter. So what we've shown is that the axion fits perfectly into this misalignment mechanism, namely that at high temperatures, this is basically theta effective. That's just a parameter of your theory. No, I shouldn't say that. It's theta, you know, initial. It's basically set by the dynamical conditions. Then there's some vacuum here, which is the vacuum that cancels the theta parameter, and that turns on at lambda QCD. So you're sort of somewhere on the potential, and then at the QCD transition, it turns on. And so you both cancel the theta parameter and the low energy, and you get this oscillation, which can give you dark matter. So people were very excited when this part of the story was uncovered, because it sort of seemed to fit perfectly, that we need a dark matter candidate, and we need a solution to the strong CP problem. And by adding one field, we take care of both at the same time. Now, I'm not going to go through the full calculation because we derived the formulas already for, you know, the number density and whatnot of these fields. This is derived sort of in explicit detail in Kolb and Turner 10.3. But basically, once you plug in the temperature dependence of the mass, you get something like omega dark matter is 0.3 MA over 10 to the minus 4 EV. There's some power law dependence on the mass. And then this is A over F initial squared. So this is just telling us that if we have very, very light axion mass, 10 to the minus 4 EV, then this gives us the observed dark matter abundance. And if I plug it into this formula, where MA squared is lambda QCD to the fourth over FA squared, I find that FA is about 10 to the 11 GeV. Now, if you notice, this axion mass is actually bigger than what we derived when we first talked about the misalignment mechanism. The reason is that if we plot mass as a function of time, so this is time, for the QCD axion, the mass kind of goes like this. Whereas before, we had something that went like this. And Hubble is sort of falling like this. So you see that if we want it to cross at a particular value, so let's say this is, you know, the observed oscillation value, if you have a flat mass, even if the axion mass, the Hubble, and the sort of time-independent mass all cross at the same point, you get a much smaller final mass for the m is independent of t, and this is ma as a function of t. This is basically just saying that the Hubble scale is very small, and so if you have a time-independent mass, then if I wanted to oscillate at, say, a GeV to give me this dark matter abundance, I have to have mass equal to Hubble at GeV. Whereas for the axion, the mass at lambda QCD is much bigger than the mass at a GeV. So it starts oscillating, and then the mass gets even bigger and bigger. OK, so are there any questions about the cosmology? I realize that I'm skipping a few steps here, but from the formulas we derived in class, hopefully, if you want to, you can move from those to actually just getting omega dark matter. OK, so in the remaining time, what I want to talk about is what if axions are really dark matter. So axion dark matter is very weird compared to, say, WIMP dark matter. So WIMPs, remember, had a mass of, say, 100 GeV. WIMPs have a mass that's about 10 to the minus 13 GeV. And as a result, the number densities are much smaller. So if I write down n axion over s, the number density of the axion is basically the energy density over the mass. This turns out to be about 1600 for m axion of 10 to the minus 4 eV. This is huge, right? And this is saying that the number of axions relative to the number of photons is bigger than 1, which is something that you can't have in thermal equilibrium. If something's in equilibrium, the most you can have is the number equal to the number of photons. So we have this very large, very cold population of axions. And because the number density is so high, what you can hope is that, you know, okay, they interact very weakly through this, you know, 1 over FA type interactions, but there are so many of them that maybe we can hope to see some kind of a signal. So the axion phenomenology this is dictated by the fact that for a Goldstone boson, the axion, say, fermion coupling looks like 1 over F d mu A j mu, where this is the current of the axial symmetry. Okay. This basically just comes from doing an anomalous rotation that shifts the axion into the kinetic term of the field. Okay, and so this has the form of 1 over F, d mu axion, psi bar gamma mu, gamma phi psi. And now I should point out that these psis, even though the theory we wrote down is just involving these new quarks, these could also be standard model quarks. The reason is just that, once again, we have this AGG tilde term. And so if I take my quark and I rotate it like e to the minus I over A over F quark, then suddenly the axion pops from being in the anomaly term into the kinetic term for the quark. And this generates, you know, the fact that we have this Q dagger sigma bar mu d mu e to the minus I A over F Q generates exactly this kind of interaction. Okay. So basically, the axion couples to all of the fermions through this coupling. Also, the fact that it couples to fermions allows it to couple to other gauge bosons as well. So for instance, we can have axion going through a quark loop into two photons, which you might also expect just from the kinds of anomaly diagrams we were looking at. Now, this might trouble you because it kind of looks like this violates the Z2 symmetry, right? We often talked about a Z2 symmetry for dark matter. And this explicitly breaks the Z2. But if I calculate the decay width, I have to have a 1 over FA squared. I have to have 4 powers of the electric coupling, which basically corresponds to an alpha squared. And then to get the units to work out right, this has to go like mx on to the third power. And if you just plug in those numbers, you see that this is way, way, way smaller than Hubble today. So in other words, we don't care that the axion doesn't have a Z2 symmetry because it couples so weakly to everything that it doesn't decay anyway. Okay. So this is fine. So there are now a few ways that we can look for the axion through this coupling. So there are basically two classes of experiments. So the first class are astrophysical probes. I shouldn't say experiment, but it's some way of testing that the axions are actually there. And there, one of the major ways of looking for axions is axions and stars. And the motivation for doing this is that the mean free path of, say, photons or whatever else is about 2 centimeters inside the sun. Very, very short. The reason is that there's such high densities of materials that even though the sun is trying to burn quickly energy through nuclear fusion, that energy can't propagate out because it gets sort of trapped in this plasma that's there. Okay? So basically, the sun and other stars don't burn out because there is no efficient way of transporting energy out of the star. And so this sort of keeps it in a steady state. Now, however, I've added a new particle and a new interaction, and it can change the energy transport processes in stars. So in particular, I can have, for instance, say, a nucleus or an electron or something like this. It scatters off of, say, a photon in the sun. But now we have a 2-photon-1-axion coupling. So basically, what this process is gamma x goes to axion x, where x is some charged particle. And now it's so rare to have an axion scatter that it probably doesn't scatter again. So this axion is produced deep inside the sun, and then it just flies straight out of the sun. So the axion cools the sun. And again, the rate associated with this is going to go like 1 over FA squared, because there's always a 1 over FA that shows up here. So it's a very, very small rate. But there's lots of matter in the sun. And since the regular transport mechanisms are so inefficient, the high densities can compensate for this 1 over FA squared. And so it turns out just observing the energy loss of the sun and requiring that axions don't, say, exceed that. So you can do it for the sun. You can do it for white dwarfs. You can do it for supernovae. You can do all kinds of things. The bounds rule out FA less than about 10 to the 8. GeV, which corresponds to axion masses bigger than about 10 to the minus 2 eV. So somewhat remarkably, you can get very close to this sort of favored dark matter parameter space just by these astrophysical cooling arguments. Okay. And there's understandably some order one uncertainty because we don't really understand what happens in the sun, but you know, this is the order of magnitude level of the constraint. I should point out, though, that in this, where is it? Where do I have the dark matter number density? Oh, it's on the board that's gone hidden. So I wrote down the dark matter number density. I said that you get the right dark matter abundance of 10 to the minus 4 EV. But there was this, it was sort of like 10 to the minus 4 EV over MA to some power. And then A over F naught squared. So if I underproduce dark matter, so for instance, if my MA is bigger, sorry. Where is it? Sorry, yeah. It's 1 over MA to the 1.18. So if I overproduce dark matter, so if MA is smaller than 10 to the minus 4 EV, I tend to get too much dark matter. But then I can just make A naught much, much smaller than FA. So if I overproduce dark matter, I can always compensate for it by changing the initial position on my field evolution, my misalignment. Okay. I can't do that if I underproduce dark matter, because the biggest I can make A is FA. OK, so we're sort of approaching the dark matter favored region. But we're not quite there with these tests. So I will mention a second astrophysical probe. And part of this is because it was proposed by one of the faculty members of PI, Nina Arvanitaki, which she did with Sergei Dubovsky at NYU about 5 years ago or so. So the idea is that hopefully in your GR class you learned about Kerr black holes, which are basically black holes that have some spin associated with them. Now it turns out that it becomes energetically and entropically favored if you have a very light scalar to basically accrue some large like haze of the scalar. So you have some basically like axion BEC cloud that forms. Okay? And the reason is that it takes this very high angular momentum associated with essentially a point-like object, and it spreads it out. So you create this cloud surrounding the black hole, and then as a result, the spin is slower. And this is a purely kinematic effect. You can show this in just regular mechanics, that if you have some process which allows for the propagation of sort of angular momentum from the inside of an object to the outside, that this is a favorable process to have happen. So what this does is axions slow black hole spin. And so the fact that we see spinning black holes tells us that the axions can't be slowing them down too much, or else there just wouldn't be any spinning black holes left. Okay. So this ends up excluding a very different mass range, which is one of the reasons why I mention it, because this only happens for very, very light M axion, because otherwise the energy price that you pay for creating this axion cloud is not compensated for by the reduction in the rotational energy. So for regular black holes, it's sort of in this mass range. So the ranges that are ruled out are very, very light, so like 10 orders of magnitude lighter than the ones for the cooling constraints. This corresponds to an FA of about M Planck. So there's a big window, but we've kind of ruled out things that are around the Planck scale or below 10 to the 8 GeV or so in terms of this axion decay constant. Okay, so this is an illustration of the kinds of crazy astrophysical effects that you can get. And it comes from the fact that you have these very light objects which do funny things. You have to worry about quantum statistics. You have to worry about coherent effects which can modify various processes. Okay. Okay, so this is astrophysically. And I should point out that none of this relies on the axion being dark matter. all we needed were the axion to be somewhere in the theory. The reason being that here we're producing the axion out of standard model particles, so it doesn't rely on some cosmological abundance of them. Similarly, the axions are being created by some classical field effect. You're not relying on axions like from dark matter falling into a black hole or something like this. So these apply to the axion whether they constitute all the dark matter or none of the dark matter. All they depend on is if they're in your theory. Yes.
We want the right abundance.
Pardon me?
The constraints don't assume that it's dark matter and we want to get the right abundance.
That's right. Well, so
these constraints are on the QCD axion. So that this is relying on that it solves the strong CP problem, which in turn requires that it obey that mass relationship up there. Some of the lab constraints, however, do assume that it's dark matter. So the first one is called ADMX, which stands for Axion Dark Matter Experiment. And ADMX is sort of the directed detection of axions. Only because they're so light, you can't rely on it coming and recoiling off a nucleus, because it's going to deposit 10 to the minus 8 eV of energy or something ridiculously small like this. So that's no good. So what they do is they set up a B field. So this B field is sourcing photons. And then you have an axion that's coming in from the halo. And what you can get is a conversion from dark matter axion to photon. And this actually happens resonantly at E gamma equals M axion, not surprisingly. Because you have some background field that is allowing you to switch from an axion into a photon of the same energy. So there's sort of the maximum probability of that happening is when the photon is right on the energy. And for the ranges that ADMX is sensitive to, the frequency of this photon is about a gigahertz, tens of gigahertz. So what you do is you have a cavity, and you try to tune the cavity so that it has some resonant enhancement at a particular frequency. And you can do that by adjusting the physical size of the cavity. And then if the axion comes in and produces a single photon at the resonant frequency, then you get some huge enhancement and you get a big burst of photons that come out of this amplifying cavity. So if you were to see something, you would expect to see a big peak. Now, the problem is we don't know what the axion mass is. So what you have to do is take the cavity and sort of adjust the resonant frequency of the cavity so that you're scanning over all kinds of frequencies. Okay? So this makes it very difficult, because the width is about, let's say, 10 kilohertz. And the frequency is about gigahertz. So you're trying to scan gigahertz range frequencies on 10 kilohertz bins. So this just takes a very long time. So currently, ADMX excludes 10 to the minus 6 eV less than MA less than about 10 to the minus 5 eV. So this is sort of in the window where you might expect dark matter. And indeed, the experiment was designed to hit the dark matter window. They're currently finishing up an upgrade. And this could get to 10 to the minus 4 eV. And basically, what they've done is they've found a way of cooling it so that you can suppress the thermal noise. And so what you're looking for is a peak above just random fluctuations. So if you can suppress the random fluctuations, the amount of time you have to spend in each, say, 10 kilohertz bin is much shorter. So you can just scan them much faster. So you can go through many more decades of frequency. So this is very exciting because it's targeting specifically the dark matter range. But of course, as with all dark matter direct detection experiments, there are inevitably going to be some halo assumptions involved. Okay, because we're assuming that the dark matter is coming in. And the one thing that I will say where it's different from direct detection is that you're looking for a resonance, right? And so one of their strategies is if they see a little statistical fluctuation, they can just tune their cavity to where they see interesting bumps and just wait and wait and wait. And the thermal noise should quickly go, you know, to the expected value, whereas if it's a real signal, it should shoot up way above the background. And so ADMX is perhaps a little bit more believable if they see a signal, because there's very little that we could understand that astrophysically would give you some huge resonance in a completely insulated cavity. Okay, there's one more that we'll talk about tomorrow, but this pretty much wraps up the discussion of axions. So let me know if you have any questions either about the astrophysical tests or the lab tests, or any of the stuff we talked about today. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow then.